I'm Jason Mundock, and this is Around the Wood Stove, from the Wood Stove House in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Jessica Smucker is a Lancaster-based singer-songwriter. She recently visited the Wood Stove House to chat about her brand new album, This Broken Moment, which is due to be released on October 16, 2010, at a party at the Lancaster Dispensing Company. This Broken Moment is Jessica's third release and second with her band, The Sleeping World. To learn more about Jessica, visit jessicasmucker.com. To learn more about this podcast or our Wood Stove House concert series, visit us online at woodstovehouse.com. Joining me in the Wood Stove House is Jessica Smucker, who is no stranger to the Wood Stove House. Jessica actually played with Jeff Bryson at the very first official Wood Stove House concert in April of last year, and also recorded an EP in the Wood Stove House studio last year that came out earlier this year. But that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about a brand new record called This Broken Moment by Jessica Smucker and The Sleeping World. Let's talk about the band, The Sleeping World, and who are the players in the current lineup?
Okay, so we have... I play keys and sing lead vocals, obviously. And then Aaron Mattern sings backup vocals. Dave Schaefer plays bass. Rich Sexton on guitar. And Mike Roy plays the drums.
And I know there's been some changes in lineup over the years. Are any of these folks, have any of these folks been with you the entire time that there's been The Sleeping World?
No. Erin has been with me the longest, and she started, I believe she started the band in January of 2008, something like that, early 2008, right before we recorded
the first EP. So she's been there almost 3 years, two and a half years. Mm-hmm. And the other guys, like, how long has this current configuration really been together?
Mike is the most recent, and he started in June of 2009. And before that, Rich and Dave joined me in about January of that year.
Okay.
So this group has been together roughly a year and a half, give or take.
Yeah.
You know, originally it was just The Sleeping World. And as I started doing more solo shows, I felt like it was going to get confusing, and just stuff like I had two Sonic Bids pages. I it was a lot of maintenance, and it was actually more expensive to have it as two separate things. So, and because we do function as a band as far as creating the arrangements and all of that, but as far as the songs and all of that, I mean, it's my songs, it's my band. I'm the through line. Everybody's cool with that. Everybody sort of understands that. And so, I talked to the band earlier this spring about, you know, how they would feel about me starting to bill it as Jessica Smucker and The Sleeping World instead of just by the band name, and everybody was fine with that. And I think it helps to fix some of the possible confusion with having two sort of separate projects. So
I'm not blind, but I wanted to be. To wrap myself inside a dark cocoon, the land of the free. I get so tired of the undertow of all the things I can't let go. Oh, 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 there is nothing we can do or say to make the river flow the opposite way. We're spending all our time these days just learning how to be okay. Good things will come and go, but the blues are here to stay.
Players on the new album, it's the full band, all the musicians that are currently in the band. And then who else played on this? Because I know there were some other instruments I heard.
Yes. Yeah. Robin Chambers did... Some viola and violin on five songs. I think originally we had planned to have her on three songs, and we just kept finding more uses for her.
Yeah.
Charlie Burnett, who recorded the album, played double bass on two songs. Ron Barnett did a synthesizer part on one song.
Quite a cast.
Yeah.
It's a good lineup.
Yeah, definitely. Jeff Bryson did backup vocals on one song. I can't do a recording without him on it.
Right.
So far.
How was it recording with Charlie?
It was wonderful. I had a really, really great experience working with him. And he has a home studio. There's some aspects of it that aren't technically ideal. There was no control room. There was everything was, just in one room. It was a pretty low ceiling, so that affected the drum tracks. But he really likes to use an organic process. He's a big Beatles fan, so he's really interested in some kind of retro ideas. He has a tape machine that he runs a lot of things through. So you'll really savvy ear would hear that on this recording, that we ran a lot of the piano tracks, a lot of the vocal tracks we ran through a tape machine.
Well, that's interesting, because the overall feel of the record for me was this, like the first thing that jumped out was it had this sort of early 70s mm-hmm. feel to it, not knowing any of this about how it was recorded. It's smooth, mm-hmm. It's an easy to listen to record. It reminds me a lot in the way that it sounds of Wilco's Sky Blue Sky.
Oh.
It's another record mm-hmm. that's very similar in it's kind of dry.
Mm-hmm.
The instrumentation's very similar. In fact, I went back and listened to some tracks from that after listening to mm-hmm. yours, because it was reminding me of it. And a lot of the instrumentation was very similar. There was mm-hmm. like a Hammond organ with a piano part, with bass and guitar that were very clean. I got that.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice to hear. Yeah.
And that was just, out of this blue sky, mm-hmm. as it were. Yeah. That's great. I mean, compared to the first Sleeping World EP,
mm-hmm.
It's a very different record. It's mm-hmm. a very different, you can really, if you put those two records up next to each other, I think one would guess that you swap musicians.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a real rock feel to the first one, mm-hmm. but particularly the drums. Whereas on this album, like I said, it's smooth, and there's also a lot of jazz sort of mm-hmm. elements layered over top of this sort of early 70s kind of rock feel.
Yeah.
So it came out really, it came out really well. How are you writing these songs for the band? Are you bringing things to the table and really directing, or are you putting something out there and letting the band sort of take it and run with it?
Most of the time, I am bringing in a very raw piano piece with piano and vocals, and bringing it to the band and letting them sort of do what they hear with it, and then I sort of have. I sort of have veto power.
Right.
And certain songs we've had trouble with over the years, it's like they're not hearing what I hear in it, but I have trouble communicating what I do hear.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are songs that a lot of times I've learned to just sort of let those go and bring them back later, reintroduce them every now and then. But yeah, the band does a lot of the arranging. I'm starting to get to the point where I can do a little bit more of that. Just the accumulated knowledge of the last 3 years or so, I'm starting to feel somewhat qualified to do it.
Well, I think the band has really found a voice, because mm-hmm. it's a very consistent album.
Mm-hmm.
When you listen to it from beginning to end, it's the same. It's the same band,
mm-hmm.
and that's hard. Especially a relatively new band. This mm-hmm. is only a band that's been together for really a year.
Yeah.
A lot of times you'll have a lot of different styles and a lot of, people are trying different things, mm-hmm. but there's a real consistency.
That's good to hear too. And that was surprising when the whole way through the process, I kept telling Charlie, I'm like, I don't know if this is going to feel like an album. I feel like, because the songs themselves came from, Mermaid's Kiss is probably the oldest one, and that song is probably 10 years old. And then there's ones that I wrote this year.
Wow.
And there's ones that I wrote with the band in mind. And there's ones that I wrote when I never thought I would have a band.
Well, you did a great job tying them together.
Yeah. And so that happened naturally, because I didn't know how to make it happen. So.
Well, that's good. And that's a credit to Charlie
mm-hmm.
and the way that he recorded it mm-hmm. and staying very consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about some of the songs.
Sure.
Mermaid's Kiss, you mentioned, is an older song.
Mm-hmm.
Really my favorite song on the mm-hmm. album so far. Is there a story behind that song?
Yeah. The idea that I was mulling over in the song was I was thinking about how the fascination with Hollywood actresses and models and the sort of completely inaccessible, beautiful woman reminded me of the, you know, ancient fascination with mermaids. Mm. And the idea that there's this incredibly sexual creature on one hand, but completely unavailable on the other hand. And that the, I was just created this parallel in my head. And so the song was sort of built around that idea. And I didn't really have a specific target. I mean, a lot of my songs end up being in the second person, like they're being written to somebody. Mm-hmm. I didn't really have a specific target for that song, except that it was, you know, maybe the idea of writing it to a male friend who's always chasing after the inaccessible woman. And so there's a lot of anger and frustration in the song. I mean, I would consider it probably, I would think of it as a very feminist song.
Brain and tongues on your wedding day, yeah. I was gonna be the one to prophesy your mermaid wife. How she'd only stood down from the movie screen long enough for you to take a bite. I wanted more than your bed. I'ma keep it a words like arrows shooting straight to your head. Gonna be the one. But there she was with her hair hung down in the ocean on her back.
Let's talk about There and Back Again. Mm-hmm. Another song that kind of jumped out at mm-hmm. me. Excellent musicianship mm-hmm. on this song. What's behind that one?
That was written this year. It was written really just in time to make it onto the album. And
there's some dark themes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was really, I was thinking about home, about sort of the benefits and the perils of being in your hometown, mm-hmm. and how being home can be such a comfort and such a trap. And the song's really about that. And I think even the structure of the song is kind of, you know, the verses, there's a little bit of a hypnotic repetition that's happening that's sort of supposed to maybe make you feel a little bit constricted. And then you get to the chorus and the idea is that, you know, a gate opens or something and there's a little bit of freedom and breath. And even the title There and Back Again, I mean, obviously that was put on afterwards, but it was sort of like, I mean, the song, it's not just about being at home. It's about coming back home. It's about returning home. And I think for a lot of people, that's a very complicated time, returning home.
Yeah, and that's the back again.
Mm-hmm, yeah. You know, I think the last line of the song, when it kind of just drops off, but it's this sort of epiphany that's also a disappointment, you know, my big disappointment, there's no place like home. And saying that as not necessarily a good thing.
Right.
I mean, I think it's a very nuanced song and I think it doesn't really have a clear statement one way or the other, which is often the case about being at home.
Sometimes the world just isn't big enough. I want to squeeze myself out of this womb. If hope is a cut, I am the razor blade. If love is a dirt pile, I am the broom. Follow my own rules, listen to no fool. Flow like a leaf in the breeze. It doesn't matter where I lay my head, as long as I can breathe.
New Year's song contains the name of the album. Mm-hmm. Talk about that one.
Yeah. That was another one that was just written this year. I mean, I started writing it on... I was at a New Year's Eve party, and I often don't feel like being at a party on New Year's Eve. I actually really... I think New Year's is my favorite holiday because I take it seriously. Like, I think of it as a time to reflect and think about, you know, a clean start or how to do a little bit better.
Yeah.
But lately, in recent years, I sort of, you know, a fresh start seems naive. And so I haven't really known what to do with New Year's. It's kind of like it's this marker that I want to acknowledge. But I don't really know that it means what it used to mean to me. The song is really about letting go and about, instead of trying to force a reality, to take the one that's here and make the most of it. So, you know, the line that the title of the album is based on, it says, "If I have to drown in your dark sea, well, I can be brave. I'm not going to let this broken moment slip away." And I mean, for me, that's about seizing a moment that isn't great, seizing a moment that kind of sucks, but deciding that I'd rather take it and run with it than try to pretend it's something it's not. When I was writing it, I kind of wanted to do what I was thinking about U2's song, October. I love that song, and I love how there's a long piano intro and then a few words. Yeah. And a long piano outro. That's sort of how I wanted to structure that song. And I was on the fence about whether I wanted to put it on the album. And I was over at Charlie's studio really late one night, and I just started playing around on his Hammond. And I started playing that song, and he perked up right away. He was just like, "Well, what is that?"
Yeah.
And so I kept playing it, and I was like, you know, I was going to do this on the album with the band, but it doesn't feel quite right with the band. I'm just not sure, you know, if it belongs or not. And he was like, "Well, let's record it right now. We're just going to do it on the Hammond." He set some kind of weird setting on the Hammond. I'm not sure what it was. And just had me play it and do the vocals, everything right then. So you'll hear, like, in the background of that song, you can really hear the Hammond and all of its noises when it turns on and the clicking of the keys. Mm-hmm. And stuff like that. So then after we had done my keys and vocals, I still wasn't sure what I wanted to do with it. And Charlie seemed to have a vision for what he wanted to do with it. And I said, you know, I think in the spirit of letting go, as the song is, I was like, why don't I just give you this song and you can do what you want to do with it? So, and initially the plan was that I wasn't even going to hear it at all. And then gradually I got more involved in the arrangement of the song. And then I pulled back and then I got involved again. And then at the end, after we had done everything on it, and this was like a week before we were going to mastering because we were really kind of last minute with it, I was like, I don't like it.
Yeah.
And I think that was the one time, maybe not the one time, but it was one of the times that Charlie probably wanted to kill me. And then I was like, you know what? I told you that you could have the song. And
let it go.
And I'm going to let it go. Yeah. And I said, I think that I'm going to like it. I think I'm going to like it, but I couldn't tell for sure. So now I do. I really like it. It's very different than what I would have done with it myself. But I think it's like a lot of title songs on albums. It's very different from everything else. Mm-hmm. I think it still fits in the flow, but it's a little breather right before the end of the album.
Yeah. And, yeah, I like where it's placed.
Mm-hmm. And so yeah, that's how that song came to be.
Thank you. This is a long awaited day of jubilee.
So Mercy's this song that's got a jazz flavor to it, but it also has a Latin flavor.
Mm-hmm.
Great song. Tell us about that one.
Well, I keep saying that's the song that's going to get me in trouble. And of course, I'm always going to be talking about these songs lyrically first, because that's sure. really what comes first for me. At the time that I wrote Mercy, I wrote it around the time that we recorded the first EP. And during that time, I was writing, almost all my songs were about my divorce or about God or religion in some sense. And Mercy was sort of where all of those things came together. I think that it was written out of what I would call the moral ambiguity of going through a divorce. And really, it's about two things. It's about a failed marriage, and it's about a failed faith. It's almost more about the failed marriage, but it's using the failed faith as the metaphor. And so, you know, I don't try to be a provocative lyricist. I don't try to write things that are going to upset people. I'm a middle child and a Mennonite, so I'm pretty mediative.
So you fail
so
in that attempt to
I failed
not...
in my attempt to not provoke. Because, and this is the case with the lines that turn out to be the truest in some of my songs are also the ones that I tried very, very hard not to write. And there are a couple of those in Mercy. And it was just like these lines would keep coming back to me. I'm like, no, you can't write that. You cannot write that. You cannot write that. and I had to. But I think, and I don't want to go into a lot of detail about the specific lines, but overall, I want to say that the song is grappling with two sort of failed relationships, a failed reality, and it's looking for something to replace itself and realizing that, no, that was it. Like, if I can't have my faith in God the way it was when I grew up, I can't just jump to another religion. This is the only one. Mm-hmm. This is the only one that I know how to relate to, and yet it's broken. If I can't have the marriage that I started with, I can't get married again. I can't have this type of relationship again. It's permanently broken. And then the idea of mercy, it's like I'm sort of appealing to the concept of mercy in my faith, and just, it's sort of a plea at the end, and it's sort of talking about the failures of mercy. Like, you can have this concept that's really great and powerful, and entire religions rest upon it, and yet in those moments when everything falls apart, it feels completely inaccessible.
When it should be most accessible.
It should be the most accessible, yeah. But there's also sort of this idea of being chased by it, of that whether or not I accept the idea of grace and forgiveness and mercy and all those things in my life, that they sort of come after me anyway. That I'm forgiven and I'm free and I'm okay whether I want to be or not. So it's pretty intense stuff.
Yeah, not party music.
Not party music. And yet my father and his friend were dancing like crazy to that song at a show a couple weeks ago. So it's got the Latin feel, so it does
right.
It does make you want to move.
Yes, it does.
I see the shadows move across the sky. I see the stars are falling down on you, and I keep hoping maybe can handle everything just right, but then one day you see your entire life, a magician's claw was pulled right out from under you. You mistook me for a lullaby, but I'm a wrecking ball, I'm a thief at night, I'm the empty room that greets you in the morning light. You wanna or salvage something from this mess. Turn our impending doom into a big success. But I've got nothing left, and baby, I'm content to fail. I've been reaching for the wrong end. Where's your fake war up in my head? Starving body just to spite the soul.
You did something with this album that has been pretty innovative for the last couple of years for musicians, and that is to try to raise money beforehand. You know, the traditional model about a record, especially an independent record, is that you find the money somewhere, you pay for it, and then you go sell it and try to recuperate them, you know, try to recoup the money. But this model is where you reach out to your fan base beforehand and try to raise the money in advance. Tell me about the different ways that you attempted that and then how they worked out.
Sure. Well, the one thing I did was I set up an account on a website called feedthemuse.net. There are a number of websites like that. That was the one that for whatever reason I was exposed to first. And you can set up an account where people can go on and it's sort of set up like a pre-order, but it's also set up like a donation. There are different monetary amounts that they can give, and then it's set up where there's sort of a trade-off. You know, if you give $75 or more, you get your name in the liner notes, stuff like that.
Were those tiers predetermined, or is that something that you make up?
I made them up. Okay. I made them up. The use of that website was, I would say, moderately effective. I mean, I posted a lot of links to it on Facebook and on my email list, and I would say that it was probably fewer than 15 people actually used the website to give money in advance. I also had a couple people come up to me just around town and say, you know, they saw the links and they said, hey, I want to pre-order. And I was like, well, you know, you can do it directly through me.
Right.
I make more of the money that way because I think Feed the Muse takes out a percentage. I can't remember if it's 6% or 10%. And then I also did a backyard concert, and that was for friends and family and whoever wanted to come, pretty much. It was a fundraiser, and I played 3 different sets. It was like a 3-hour drop-in, and we had a tip jar out that was just for people to give money in general, and then we had somebody going around taking pre-orders. So I actually made more from that backyard concert than I did from the website.
I love the idea of the backyard concert to raise money, mm-hmm. specifically because, and I'm not surprised that you did better with that,
mm-hmm.
because I think when people are in your presence, it's just like buying CDs.
Mm-hmm.
When people are in your presence and they can experience something, they're more willing to drop some money into a bucket and say, yeah, you know what, I think I will support this. This is kind of a cool thing.
Yeah. And it was also really significant for people in my extended family who knew that I'd been doing music but hadn't really ever seen it. It was a way to get those people involved in my life and what I'm doing in a way that I think was unexpectedly rewarding for them. My grandmother was there, and
yeah.
you know, she had no idea.
You're probably not going to get her out to a bar.
Probably not. Yeah.
To see the band.
Yeah.
Mercy, you're the gun that hunts me down. Mercy.
So So the CD release is October 16th, 2010, and you're having a CD release party where?
At the Lancaster Dispensing Company. It'll start around 9:30, and we'll probably play three sets. Yeah. Have a nice long night.
Of course, the CDs will be for sale there. Yes. Where else can somebody find the new disc?
Good question. they will be on iTunes. Okay. And I haven't talked with any local stores or anything like that. I will probably try to get them out somewhere in Lancaster. And as far as distribution goes, I mean, all of that is very up in the air right now.
Well, give me a handful of Desert Island Discs.
Okay. let's see. Probably Over the Rhine's Films for Radio. That one's been a big influence on me. So lately I've been into Martha Wainwright and her self-titled first album.
She's pretty spunky.
She is. She's very provocative. And I love her voice. I love what she does with her voice. I think she's really intense, which I guess makes sense that I would like that. I've also been really into the latest U2 album. Shoot, what's it called?
The title.
No Line on the Horizon.
Oh, right. The titles of those U2 records don't really mean anything.
Yeah, yeah. I really like that one. I don't know if it would make the long term, you know, forever right. Desert Island.
But if you were just vacationing there,
but like
you
right
might,
now, yeah, I would take that one with me.
Yeah, that's great.
And one that I've been into lately that I think will probably wear off soon is the new Norah Jones album. We actually based the general sound of this album. We had that album in mind when we were making it. They don't sound alike,
right?
Except like the guy that did the mastering for this one knew that we wanted to do right. something, and so
it was a baseline from which to work. It was
exactly. So that's one.
Give me a really old record, something that you like as a kid you loved and you just will always be with you.
Yeah. Well, I love as a kid. The album that I can't get a hold of anymore was Anne Murray Sings Sesame Street. It's a record. It's never been put out on CD. I don't think it even made it to tape.
Wow.
And that was a wonderful album. I don't know what happened to our copy of it, but
you might need to check like the record thing over there, the used record convention at the hotel every Sunday or whatever that is.
Yeah, that was a wonderful.
Of course, you might spend a lot of time digging through those piles of records before you come up with that one.
Yeah. Oh, and I can't. Leonard Cohen, anything by Leonard Cohen. I would take as much Leonard Cohen.
The whole
with
discography.
Me. The whole entire Leonard Cohen.
You'd burn an MP3 disc.
Yeah.
Or just a DVD take all that. Of MP3.
That'd be enough to get me through. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time and joining me. This has been really cool. Thanks.
Likewise. Thank you.
Around the Wood Stove is a production of the Wood Stove House with inspiration from the creative works of Lancaster. Our theme song is the old-time traditional tune, Buck Dancer's Choice, performed by Jeff Sims and myself, Jason Mundock. Find us on the web at woodstovehouse.com.